You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma-Louise Fenelon.
Legal practitioners will be familiar with the principle of open justice, if not necessarily capable of reciting from memory the oft-cited words of Lord Atkinson in the 1913 House of Lords decision Scott and Scott, in which he stated, "The hearing of a case in public may be, and often is, no doubt, painful, humiliating, or deterrent both to parties and to witnesses, and in many cases, especially those of a criminal nature, the details may be so indecent as to tend to injure public morals. But all this is tolerated and endured because it is felt that in public trial is to be found, on the whole, the best security for the pure, impartial, and efficient administration of justice, the best means for winning for it public confidence and respect." More specifically, clinical negligence practitioners will be familiar with the case of JXMX and the practice whereby anonymity orders are routinely made in approval hearings in relation to children and protected parties. Here with me to talk about two recent interesting and very different decisions on anonymity is Raj Kiran Barhay from 1 Crown Office Row. Kiran, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
In March this year, a High Court decision was handed down concerning an anonymity application in a clinical negligence claim. Can you tell us a little bit about the facts of the case?
Yes, so in Zarumpka Smith and United Lincolnshire Hospitals NHS Trust, the substantive claim was about a stillbirth that the claimant had suffered and consequent psychiatric injury. And she was bringing a clinical negligence claim against the NHS Trust, who had admitted liability for the stillbirth and part of the claimant's damages claim. The parties couldn't agree on the appropriate quantum of damages, and therefore it went to trial. On the first day of the trial, the claimant applied for an anonymity order to prohibit publication of her name. And in support of this application, both her solicitor and counsel made submissions that identification of the claimant could cause irreparable damage to the family unit, to interfere with her private life, and potentially lead to a risk of suicide. And they further noted that the public interest could be served without the need for disclosure of the claimant's name. It was also relevant that the claimant had two other children, and she was particularly worried that publication of her name could lead to identification of those children, and some of the evidence related to her existing relationship with her children. And so she was particularly worried about those sorts of facts becoming public. The NHS Trust took a neutral stance on the application. However, the Press Association intervened and argued that although the claimant's Article 8 ECHR rights were engaged, the court also had to consider Article 10, namely the freedom of the press. They argued that it was exceptional for the court to grant anonymity orders in cases where the claimant was not a protected party. And they said that in those particular cases, anonymity orders should only be made where absolutely necessary in the interests of the administration of justice. And they further made the point that they were signatories to the Independent Press Standards Organisation Code of Conduct, which set out quite clear guidance about how to responsibly report on the issues raised by the case. And they said that all of the claimant's concerns about privacy could properly be met, provided that they adhered to the guidance in the code.
He referred to two cases in particular when reviewing the various jurisprudence surrounding anonymity. One of those was the well-known case of JXMX. How did he consider this case fundamentally different to the case of JXMX?
So the key difference between those two cases is that JXMX was about an approval hearing. So for those that aren't familiar with what they are, essentially it's when two parties come to a settlement agreement in respect of a person who's either a child or doesn't have capacity to consent to that agreement. And that has to go before the court for the judge to approve it. And there's no choice for the parties to circumvent that process. It's a requirement. And that was one of the things that the judge pointed to that made it different from the present case, that in an approval hearing setting, the parties have no choice but to go before the court. They can't just settle the case privately and avoid proceedings. The other thing that he said that was different between approval hearings and the present proceedings was that when the court is approving a settlement, the court is exercising its protective function, which is fundamentally different from its ordinary function of deciding disputes between parties.
Another case that was referred to in the judgment was ABC and St. George's Healthcare Trust, which was a decision with very unusual facts. This case has been covered on the UK Human Rights blog, and listeners may be familiar with it, but in that case, the claimant's father had been diagnosed with Huntington's disease, which is a genetic condition, and a sufferer's child has a 50% chance of inheriting it. The claimant subsequently discovered that she too had Huntington's disease, and it was her case that if she had been given this information when she ought to have been, she would have terminated a subsequent pregnancy. She was not given that information and a child was born to her, and it was her case that anonymity was necessary because there was a real risk that her daughter would find out not only that she had a 50% chance of inheriting Huntington's disease, but also that had her mother known that in the past, she would have terminated her pregnancy. Obviously, this is a case where the claimant had capacity. So how was this case considered suitable for anonymity? And why is it that Spencer J did not consider the present case suitable for anonymity?
So in his own words, he found that the circumstances were wholly different and exceptional. And the words that he used were that the revelation of the matters personal to this claimant and her family are inherent and intrinsic to a claim of this nature, relating as it is to psychiatric injury suffered by the claimant from the stillbirth of her daughter. Having chosen to bring these proceedings in order to secure damages arising out of that tragedy, the claimant cannot avoid the consequences of having made that decision in terms of the principle of open justice and the consequent publicity potentially associated with such proceedings. So I think what Spencer J was getting at is that the damages that the claimant was seeking in this case were for psychiatric injury. In comparison, in ABC, the damages that the claimant was seeking, they're a variety, but I think that they were not as intrinsically connected to the matters that she wanted to keep secret in that case in the same way as they were in this case. So it's a reasonably difficult distinction, I think, to understand without having quite a good knowledge of the facts of both of those cases. But I think that's probably the most succinct way of explaining it.
And obviously in ABC and St. George's Healthcare, that was a case in which the child that the anonymity order sought to protect was actually potentially at risk of developing or inheriting Huntington's disease, whereas the facts of this case concerned the psychiatric harms suffered by the claimant herself.
Yes, exactly.
And then turning to another case, also recently handed down in January this year, the case of General Medical Counsel and Dr. X. Can you tell us a little bit about the facts of these cases?
Yes, so in this case, Dr. X was a neonatologist, so they treated very young children. And they had been accused of sexual misconduct, specifically in engaging in a sexual conversation with someone that they knew to be under the age of 16. And the Medical Practitioners Tribunal upheld these allegations of sexual misconduct and also of dishonesty because it was found that Dr. X had then tried to cover up these allegations. As a result of the finding of sexual misconduct and dishonesty, the Medical Practitioners Tribunal imposed a 12-month suspension on Dr. X's registration, subject to further review. Dr. X then made an application requesting the GMC to not publish any part of the determination other than the fact of the suspension for 12 months on the grounds of misconduct. It's relevant to note that in these cases, the GMC would ordinarily publish the name of the doctor, a summary of the nature of the allegations and the finding, and details of the sanction that was imposed upon the doctor. There wasn't really any dispute between the parties in this case as to the applicable principle. So everyone agreed that Article 2, ECHR, the right to life, was engaged. And the question was really about the balance between Article 2 and the wider public interest, which tended in favour of publishing details about the finding against Dr. X. Dr. X's main argument was that there was significant psychiatric evidence which showed that they suffered from depression and that there were a continuing and significant risk of committing suicide. And that risk of suicide particularly stemmed from Dr. X's concerns about public disclosure of their sexuality and also a more general concern about publication of the sexual misconduct allegations. In particular, they relied on a lot of medical evidence that demonstrated that the risk of suicide was so high that publication would breach Article 2. The GMC didn't really dispute that the psychiatric evidence showed that Article 2 was engaged, but their main argument was that the risk of suicide had to be balanced against the public interest in publication. And they said in this case there was a very strong public interest in maintaining public confidence in the integrity of the register. So they said if the register simply stated that Dr. X had been suspended but didn't provide any reasons, that confidence in the integrity of the register would be damaged. And they further argued that redactions as to the gender and sexuality of Dr. X would be sufficient to mitigate the concerns that they had. Ultimately, Justice Sewell found that the court must carry out this balancing exercise and accepted that there was a very weighty public interest in the integrity of the register. However, he found that in this case, that the medical evidence was very strong and it did show that there was a real and immediate risk of Dr. X's suicide if publication occurred. So he ultimately found that on the particular facts of this case, that risk overwhelmed the public interest and therefore publication would breach Article 2.
And that can be contrasted with the kind of evidence that was submitted on behalf of the claimant in Zaromska Smith. And in that case, the application for anonymity was supported by, as is the practice in clinical negligence cases like that, a witness statement that had been written by the claimant's solicitor. But it was not supported specifically by medical evidence.
Yes, exactly. And I think my view is that that's one of the most significant differences between the two cases. And particularly if you read the Dr. X judgment, the vast majority of the court's reasoning is directed at the strength of the psychiatric evidence in that case.
One final takeaway from practitioners might relate to timing, and I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about the warning shot that was fired by Mr. Justice Spencer in Zaromska Smith.
Yes, so that's an interesting factor in this judgment. So the application for anonymity was made at the start of day one of the quantum trial. And Spencer J noted that this didn't give the press association enough time to make properly considered submissions. And so he directed some criticism at the claimant's representatives and said that they ought to have made the application earlier. And he particularly noted that the failure to make that application earlier deprived the claimant of making a properly informed choice about whether or not to accept a settlement in this case. Because he noted that in the mix of factors that goes into whether a claimant accepts a settlement or not, one of the factors that they will consider is their privacy. And the claimant wasn't able to consider that in accepting or rejecting a settlement in this case. And he said that it might have affected her decision to settle the claim out of court if she'd known that she wouldn't have been granted anonymity. He therefore warned claimants and their advisers against assuming that a court would just nod through such applications.
Indeed, and his words in the final paragraph of his judgment are robust. He says, for these reasons, as you've outlined, an application for anonymity should be made well in advance of the trial, and claimants and their advisers should not assume that the application will be entertained at the start of the trial because of the disruption to the trial which may ensue if the application needs to be adjourned to enable the press association time to prepare submissions, nor that it will be nodded through by the judge where the defendant takes a neutral stance and there is only a court reporter to represent the interests of the press. So I think it's certainly a judgment that solicitors practicing in the field of clinical negligence will want to take note of.
Yes, absolutely.
Listeners will be able to find links to all of the cases referred to in today's podcast, along with a link to an article written by Kieran on specifically the Zaromska Smith judgment. Kieran, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenlon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.